You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. The U.S. Supreme Court this morning released its highly anticipated decision that overturns the constitutional right to an abortion. Upending half a century of precedent from Roe v. Wade, the majority opinion of the court was that states should make their own decisions. Shockwaves were immediately felt here in Wisconsin, where an 1849 law is, at least in theory, now in effect, though legal challenges are likely. Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin CEO Tanya Atkinson said, clinics turned away patients today in waiting rooms after the ruling acknowledging abortion now being illegal in the state. President Biden spoke late this morning, calling it a sad day for the country in court. Here's some of what he concluded his speech with.
With this decision, the conservative majority of the Supreme Court shows how extreme it is, how far removed they are from the majority of this country. They made the United States an outlier among developed nations in the world. But this decision must not be the final word.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your reactions to this decision? What's been on your mind today? How are you feeling about it? What do you want to see happen with Wisconsin laws? Observing the 1849 law now on the books and enforceable apparently again? Or do you want action taken in the state legislature to alter that in some way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Susan Liebel is professor of political science and Warren Research Chair at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. She teaches courses in political theory and public law, among others. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Rob.
What does this mean now? What is the state of the law of the land in the United States and states around the country?
Well, it really depends where you live. And so now what we're looking at is a country that's divided into three types of states. We have states with laws that protect reproductive rights, either in their constitution or by their legislature. So the Northeast, Maine through Maryland, Illinois and Minnesota, Colorado and New Mexico, Washington, Oregon, Nevada and California. Then we have states with that have what's called trigger laws, laws that will make abortion illegal as soon as the court officially rules, or in the case of Wisconsin, an older law that is still standing. And that will create an abortion desert. We'll see like Texas, Arkansas, Mississippi, Louisiana. It will be difficult to sort of drive out of that area to find access to abortion. And there's more states than that, but I don't want to list them all out for you. And then lastly, there are undecided states, states where we're going to see political actors negotiate. We should be watching Virginia and Florida. Virginia's governor made an announcement this morning asking for a new law. Wisconsin is a state that people are going to be watching as well. And this includes a lot of states, not Michigan, Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, Florida. So big states, and so we're going to see a very different country with very different rights depending where you live.
Let's talk about what went into this ruling. We had this law in Mississippi. It seemed that Chief Justice Roberts was pulling for a narrower ruling just on that law, and upholding that, there was a 6-3 majority. Then on the decisions of whether to overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, as I understand it, Justice Roberts did not go along with that, so it was a 5-4 decision. What led the court to take this wider approach, overturning those two precedents, as opposed to the narrower approach that Justice Roberts appeared to want?
Well, there's sort of two answers. One is a constitutional law answer, and one's political. And I'll give you the constitutional law answer first, which is that, you know, the court looked at Mississippi's law and said it's constitutional because Roe and Casey were wrongly decided, what they called egregiously wrong. They said women have no right to access abortion that is covered by the U.S. Constitution. They looked at the 14th Amendment's due process clause that protects against being deprived of liberty. And they said liberty doesn't include access to abortion. They looked at the meaning of the word liberty in the context of what Americans believed and what American law covered in 1868 when the 14th Amendment was passed. So Justice Alito dismissed Justice O'Connor's arguments in Casey about bodily integrity and control over reproduction as what she called central to personal dignity and autonomy for women. Instead, Alito said abortion destroys what Roe called potential life, but what the court is now calling unborn human beings. And normally, and you said this, the court doesn't overturn its own rulings, especially ones that are 50 years old. But Alito said that overturning was required because the court had been wrong. And going forward, the court will look only at whether the state's legislation was rational, and it won't subject it to careful scrutiny based on gender or liberty rights. And Justice Roberts's opinion was important. So was Justice Kavanaugh's. So Justice Kavanaugh didn't sign the majority opinion. He used softer language. And he explicitly said that preventing women from traveling to another state to obtain an abortion would be unconstitutional. Justice Roberts was angry, really angry. He agreed that Mississippi's law was constitutional, but for really different reasons. He said, you know, the core holding in Roe and Casey is that women have a right to choose. And he thought 15 weeks gave women time to realize that they were pregnant and make a choice. And he harshly chastised the court majority for overturning precedent, for judicial activism, and for jolting the legal system. And he thought the court should have been more restrained. Just answered the question, is Mississippi law unconstitutional? So this was wider ranging than it needed to be.
Talking to Susan Liebel from St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, looking at this morning's U.S. Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe v. Wade. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions. Let's go to your calls now. Bill is with us in Superior. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I'm in support of the Supreme Court's decision, and I've got 3 points to make about the whole decision. My first point is the Supreme Court didn't ban anything. They can't ban laws. There was never a federal law banning abortion. My second point is it has nothing to do with reproductive rights or reproductive health, because if you're pregnant, obviously the reproduction system's kind of working. And my third point is it has nothing to do with taking equality away from women, because I'm pretty sure it's been illegal for men to kill babies forever, too.
Bill, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. His first point, Susan, accurate. The Supreme Court isn't banning abortion. It's allowing states to do so if they so wish.
Yes, that's true. I guess what I would say to Bill is points two and three, you know, need a little bit of fleshing out. When you say that women's bodies are working, that makes it seem as if all pregnancies are chosen. And we know that incest and rape are problems in the United States, and that children are the victims of both incest and rape. So when we make statements as radical as what Bill just said, I think we're one, out of step with public opinion in the United States, and two, we're out of step, even if you want to go back to the law, of punishing people for rape, for incest, and for looking at pregnancy in a much more nuanced manner. In terms of equality, I think this is very, very important. Women's bodies and men's bodies are different. And because women carry fetuses, they are subject to choices about employment, health, and finances. And there are superb studies. I would tell people to Google the Turnaway study that show what happens when women don't have access to decide whether or not to expand their families. Most women who seek abortions in America have children, and they are looking to make decisions that are personal about how it is that they will move forward in their lives.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Rita in La Crosse. Rita, hi.
Hi. I'm livid. I cannot understand how they think they have the right to tell a woman what to do with her body. These are decisions that are made in a family between a husband and a wife, and they have no right to do that. They make us second-class citizens again, and when will it end with the rights that they're taking away? I'm just so angry about this. I have grandchildren that should be able to decide what they want to do with their own bodies.
Rita, thanks for the call. Susan?
Rita, your anger was reflected in the dissent written by Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. They were strident. They accused the court of judicial activism. And they said the word liberty means bodily integrity. It means access to birth control. It means making decisions about how you travel or how you have sex or whom you marry. And for them, like you, the ruling meant women would not be free and equal citizens in the United States. And they used very harsh words about destroying women's autonomy, especially women who don't have enough wealth to travel to another state to obtain an abortion. And I want to underline that, you know, in the case we saw yesterday on guns, the court was saying that we're now going to look at history. And in this case, the dissent was very upset that looking at history in 1868 meant that women wouldn't have rights, because women didn't have the same rights in 1868 as they do now. And they weren't part of the public that passed the 14th Amendment. So I would say read the dissent. I think that you'll see a lot of the arguments that you're making made by the three justices.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Susan Liebel about today's U.S. Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe v. Wade. She's a professor of political science at St. Joseph University. You could join in with your reaction, your question about what happens next, what you want to see happen next, and let us know if this is a voting issue for you one way or another. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about the Supreme Court ending the what had been viewed as a constitutional right to an abortion in previous decisions. Susan Liebel is with us, chair and professor of political science at St. Joseph's University. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Andrew is with us in Palmyra. Andrew, hi.
Hi, I've got just two quick points. The first point would be regarding the rape and incest argument. People point to this and they say, well, this is why abortion has to be allowed. And my question would be is, if conservatives were to say, okay, rape and incest will allow abortion, however, any other case where it's something that's elective and it's not rape or incest, those are legislated against, would they be okay with that? Secondly, when the argument of it's a woman's body comes up, I'd like to ask, how many fingers, how many toes, how many legs, how many hands does a woman have? Because that's not her body that they're talking about eliminating. That's not her unique set of genetic code that they're talking about ending. So it's not her body that they're going to be eliminating. And I think those are two points that need to be discussed.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Susan, your thoughts.
Well, the implications of what Andrew is raising would mean that we would return to a very different world in which women do not have the same rights to make decisions about their jobs or their social and political worlds that men do. And the implication of what Andrew is saying is that we could also regulate women's pregnancies if we come to see the fetus as a life that is equal to a woman's, which is, I think, if I understand Andrew correctly, his argument, then we could regulate whether they smoked cigarettes or whether they went to the gym. In other words, the fetus, and Justice Thomas would like to see us go in this direction, would have equal standing with her. I'd also like to point out that not all religions believe what Andrew has just said. So the idea that life begins at conception is a strongly held religious belief by some Americans of some religions. There are other Americans with equally strong held beliefs who are part of religions that require abortion. Judaism is one of those religions that requires a preference for the life of the mother, and for 5,000 years they have held that as their position. So the position that Andrew is suggesting, and that the court may be suggesting, would open up problems for the First Amendment. How would we guarantee the right of different people to exercise their religions?
We heard a comment on our online comment section on our website asking, if a pregnant person has a miscarriage, can they get medical help to pass the tissue, or is that also illegal now? They go on, I just got married this month. I'm debating if it's even worth trying to have kids, if the chance of a miscarriage could equal a chance of death with a miscarriage. You were talking about the idea of surveillance and sort of tracking what happens over the course of a pregnancy. I don't think those questions are answered yet, but do you have concerns about the policing of miscarriages?
There's a wonderful book by Renee Kramer that I recommend to the person who wrote in. She writes in a remarkably sophisticated way about how miscarriages may be criminalized and have been criminalized in the past. So the person writing in has an excellent point. Can states legislate criminalize miscarriages? Can they require women to register their pregnancies? This has been suggested as policy, so that as soon as they were pregnant, they would register with the state, and then they would have to justify why they were no longer pregnant. This raises issues that are so far beyond what I think have even been discussed publicly. And, you know, and I also want to underline that overturning Roe and Casey affects all people in the United States, because this decision reaches far beyond abortion to our rights to make choices about how to have sex, whether to access birth control, and whom we can marry. So we really have to think very, very carefully about the implications of saying that people are not free. And I just want to go back to something that was said earlier about the wording of the Constitution. Take a look at the Ninth Amendment. It says that the enumeration, the listing of rights in the Constitution, shouldn't be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. I'm not clear that the framers thought that state legislatures should be dictating whether we can buy birth control or not. I think they were making a list of some rights, but not assuming that those were the only rights that the people had.
Talking to Susan Liebel from St. Joseph's University about the U.S. Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. Back to your calls. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Greetings. Bear with me. I'm going to try and pick my words carefully. I don't want to offend anybody, but I am sick and tired of the rich politicians telling the people who put them in office that this is what you are going to do. This, they've pushed us back, just in the case of Wisconsin, into the, 19th century? Correct me if I'm wrong. It's ludicrous that somebody that sits in a political office thinks that they have the right to tell a person how they can treat their body.
Pat, thanks for the call, Susan. That gets back to what you're saying about bodily autonomy and whether, and this is kind of core to the argument here, whether the Constitution guarantees that.
I also think Pat has a really, I know Pat's feeling a lot of emotion, and a lot of Americans are feeling emotion on both sides today, and I really want to respect that. But, you know, I think underlying some of Pat's emotion is frustration. You know, most of the American people believe that there should be access to abortion. This decision is so far out of keeping with those ideas that it really puzzles people. And I think that we should understand this decision not as some sort of, oh, this is just the court behaving as it always has. That's not the case. What we're seeing is two things. One, it's the result of minority rule. The six members of the court who oppose abortion are and were put on the court to oppose abortion. There's excellent scholarship in a new book out by Mary Ziegler that explains how it is that donations to the Republican Party led to the appointment of these justices. The Republican Party did not see abortion as part of its policy priorities until it was forced to do so by donations. So what we're seeing is a form of extremism that's out of touch with what Americans feel. But the problem, and I think Pat says this well, is that how would you vote to overturn this? So Justice Alito said women can go out and vote, but actually, and I think people in the state of Wisconsin know this well, gerrymandering, voter suppression, certain rules that place the vote out of reach for some people mean that registering your vote is actually quite difficult. And there's been superb work by Rebecca Kreitzer on how women are systematically excluded from wielding political power. And she documents the different ways in which disproportionate family caretaking responsibilities end up with fewer women running for office. Women are not without electoral or political power, Alito says, but really careful research shows that in fact, in many states, women do not have the power because of party control, gerrymandering, voter suppression, et cetera. So I think that turning to the polls is very important here. And I think that in states like Wisconsin, this will be very interesting to watch because of the kind of divided government that you have.
A tweet here from Reince Priebus of Wisconsin, former Republican National Committee chair, quoting, "True, this decision sends this issue back to states, but due process and constitutional rights begin at conception. That decision is coming next for the Supreme Court." Just our last less than a minute. Do you think we'll see more efforts to restrict abortion coming from the court next?
If the Republican National Committee gets what was just suggested, with life beginning at conception as the equivalent of living and breathing and walking and thinking women, then we are talking about having a society in which women are, in fact, second-class citizens and in which we revert to a form of patriarchy that Justice O'Connor in Casey spoke to. And I think it's good to remember Justice O'Connor was one of the most conservative justices and a Republican that we saw on the court. But yet, as a woman, as somebody who graduated second in class from Stanford and unable to get a job as a lawyer, she was very conscious of the differences between treatment of men and women in the United States.
Susan, thanks. We'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today. That's Susan Liebel from St. Joseph's University looking at today's U.S. Supreme Court ruling on Roe v. Wade. We'll talk about this more on Monday. Plus, are we now living in two separate Americas? A guest says we may be headed back to a time before the Constitution. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, summer is storm season here in the state. We'll talk about how you and your family can prepare in case a natural disaster strikes and learn more about the relationship between severe weather and climate change. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, a cook shares his travels around Mexico in search of great recipes for his new cookbook. First, more than three quarters of adults in the U.S. say they've experienced extreme weather in the last 5 years, like floods, wildfires, hurricanes, and heat waves. That's according to a survey by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. In just a bit, we'll find out how you and your family can stay safe when extreme weather strikes. Now we'll take a look at the connection between a changing climate and the risk of extreme weather events. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed storms or droughts or heat waves getting worse over the course of years? How worried are you about severe weather? What questions do you have for our guest about the connection between climate change and extreme weather events? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Mann is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University. He's the author of the book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. It's available as a paperback with an update to the story. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Are we seeing more extreme weather events of various sorts in recent years?
There's no question. Here in the United States, elsewhere around the Northern Hemisphere, Europe, Asia, in the Southern Hemisphere, Australia, New Zealand, everywhere you look, we're seeing the impacts of climate change now play out in the form of these unprecedented weather extremes. And at some level, the connection is pretty basic. You make the planet warmer, you're going to get more episodes of extreme warmth, more frequent and more intense heat waves. You make the atmosphere warmer, it can hold more moisture. So when it does rain, you get more of it. You get more flooding. But at the same time, that heat dries out soils in the summer in particular, and so you get worse droughts as well. It's not rocket science. You know, there are some basic connections that tell us that this increase that we're seeing in these extreme events, these extreme weather events, is being driven by the warming of the planet, which we know in turn is being driven by our continued burning of fossil fuels and the increase in carbon pollution in the atmosphere.
I know it can be difficult to connect the dots between a particular extreme weather event. If it gets into the 90s for a couple days in Wisconsin, that could just happen by chance. It could be connected to climate change. Can you talk about how, even if you can't make that direct connection, the dice are kind of loaded?
Yeah, and the connection, and there's a whole science now that's been developed over the past couple decades, which is known as detection and attribution. You can basically use a climate model, for example, to look at a counterfactual scenario, say, where we didn't warm up the planet with carbon pollution, and a scenario where we did. And you can look in the simulations, you can look at particular types of weather events that happen in the course of the simulations, and you can tally them. How often does this sort of event happen in the counterfactual climate where we didn't warm up the planet? And how often does it happen in the actual climate simulation where we include the effect of carbon pollution? And when you see that a particular event was extremely unlikely to happen in the counterfactual scenario, but in fact happens regularly in the global warming scenario, then you can draw that connection. You can attribute the event in the same sense that we, for example, attribute deaths from cancer to from lung cancer, for example, to smoking. You know, we can't prove that any particular cigarette led to a case of lung cancer. But when we see that the increase in the prevalence of lung cancer is a factor of 100 or a factor of 1,000, it's such a large increase in the likelihood that we're comfortable in making that connection. We're comfortable in saying that, yes, somebody who smoked their whole life and died of lung cancer, they probably died from the smoking. We can make that same sort of statistical connection now with these extreme weather events. And one last point here, if anything, those attribution studies are conservative. In my view, they actually underestimate the impact that climate change is having on these extreme events, because you're relying on the ability of the models to capture all of the processes in the real world that are behind these events. And we know that there's some subtle processes related, for example, to how warming changes the behavior of the jet stream and gives us these really stagnant high and low pressure systems that give us extreme weather. The models aren't capturing that very well, so they're probably underestimating the impact that carbon pollution and warming is having on these events.
Looking back, the 1970s, when people were first really starting to take climate change seriously, it was a problem kind of down the road. In the 90s, well, our kids, maybe grandkids, we're in it now, right? We're actually feeling human impact from this stuff.
Yeah, it's not subtle anymore. It's no longer about, polar bears up in the Arctic decades from now. It's about these devastating extreme weather events that we are seeing play out in real time in Wisconsin, back here in Pennsylvania, and around the world. The bad news is that it's gotten bad enough that we can see the impacts playing out in real time. That's sort of, the tip of the iceberg. And it tells you how much worse things can get if we fail to act now, if we fail to reduce carbon emissions and stabilize the temperature of the planet.
Talking to Michael Mann from Penn State University, climate scientist there, author of the book, The New Climate War, looking at the connection between climate change and extreme weather events. Let's go to a caller at 800-642-1234. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I've been gardening for over 40 years, and I think that anyone that farms or is in touch with their environment would notice the changes. We've had more erratic frost dates early and late, and the spring and the autumn seems to have the climate in those areas that seems to change. I think the rainfalls, we used to have like rainy days. That's really rare these days to have like a rainy day, or we have someone will get like 6 inches of rain, 10 miles from here, we didn't get anything. I mean, there's all sorts of events that are happening, like the guest said.
I got you, Will. We're getting some background noise there, but point taken. Michael, can you talk about the impact on agriculture, whether it's somebody gardening at home like Willem or, a drought in some of the biggest vegetable and fruit producing areas of the country in California?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I actually have some colleagues who are at the University of Wisconsin-Madison who actually specialize in looking at the impact of climate change, for example, on farming and agriculture in the state of Wisconsin. And there's a whole outreach component where scientists actually work with, you know, farmers and ranchers who are dealing with these impacts. And it's sort of interesting because these folks tend to be sort of politically conservative. They tend to be among the groups least likely to actually, you know, accept the science of climate change. And yet they know that something is happening. That's what you hear from these stories. In Wisconsin, here in Pennsylvania, where I have colleagues who sort of do the same sort of outreach and extension to farmers and here in the state of Pennsylvania, you know, it's these people are directly in touch with their environment. Their livelihood depends on their ability to cope with the environment, with, you know, the weather, with these environmental changes. And so they're very sensitive to the changes that are impacting them. And, you know, they see it happening. And so it's absolutely the case that some of the, you know, most interesting evidence of how climate change is impacting us now actually comes from these sorts of folks, farmers and ranchers in Texas, for example, where they lost 25% of their cattle during the unprecedented 2010 drought in Texas and Oklahoma. I mean, they're seeing these impacts. It's impacting their livelihood, and that's actually sort of changing public opinion a little bit. You're seeing some of these, again, people from sort of a demographics that aren't necessarily sort of, you know, the most concerned generally about climate change. They're being forced to become concerned about it because it's impacting them.
People might hear the news that climate change is here now, it's affecting us, and think, well, all right, it's too late, so we can't do anything about it. Do our decisions now make a difference in the years to come?
Yeah, and that's really important because there is this growing sort of sense of doomism. You know, people who aren't climate change deniers, and they're just the opposite. They're extremely concerned. But in fact, they're so concerned that they have sort of fallen into this pit of despair where they're convinced that we can't do anything about the problem anymore. Ironically, that potentially leads them down the same path of disengagement and inaction as outright denial of the problem. So it's really important that, you know, when we friends and family members and colleagues who we see sort of falling into this sort of climate doomism, to make sure they understand that we can actually prevent things from getting worse. And the science actually, you know, supports that pretty strongly. The science, you know, tells us that, you know, if we stop carbon pollution into the atmosphere, the temperature of the planet stabilizes pretty quickly. And so there's a direct and immediate impact of our effort to reduce carbon emissions. If we act now, we can prevent the planet from crossing the threshold of 1.5 Celsius, 3 degrees Fahrenheit, where we'll start to see the worst impacts. But there's urgency as well. There's agency. We can make a difference, but there is urgency. We have to bring those carbon emissions down by about 50% within the next decade if we are to keep warming below that dangerous level.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That's Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State University. We talked with him about the connection between climate change and extreme weather events. Up next, we'll get advice from the state's Emergency Management Department on preparing for extreme weather. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you faced any storm damage yet this year? Are you seeing changes? Do you have questions for the state's Emergency Management Department about how to prepare for extreme weather? Are there things you've done to protect your home, your family, your business, your farm from different kinds of weather changes? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up that conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about severe weather. Wisconsin averages 23 tornadoes a year. Last year, more than 40 touched down. Our next guest tells us how to prepare for various kinds of severe weather. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you and your family have a storm preparedness plan? What does that look like? Have you put it into action this year? Do you have questions for our guest about how to prepare for different kinds of weather and natural disasters? Have you been through a big one in your community? What happened in the aftermath? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew Beckett is a public information officer with Wisconsin Emergency Management. He also runs the state's Ready Wisconsin campaign, which encourages the public to be prepared for emergencies and disasters. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into particular kinds of extreme weather events, are there some general rules you'd suggest to people to prepare for different manners of disaster?
Well, the first thing that we really encourage everyone is to be weather aware. And really what that means is making sure that you have multiple ways to receive information about what the weather is going to be for that day, but as also when severe weather alerts are issued for your area. That includes local media, NOAA weather radios, and having wireless emergency alerts enabled on your smartphone if you have one.
Let's start with heat waves. They can be, they're one of the most lethal kinds of weather-related disasters in the country, but they're not as dramatic. I think people don't necessarily pay attention to them as much. What kind of things do you want to make sure people are paying attention to?
Well, first and foremost, it's knowing the signs that your body's telling you that you're getting too hot. Being able to identify things like heat stroke or heat exhaustion, you know, that cold, clammy skin or feeling overheated itself, feeling weak, nauseous, dizzy. Those kinds of things are a sign that, you know, you need to get to a cooler area and maybe even seek medical attention if you're really feeling the ill effects, and learning how to spot those signs in others as well. I mean, those are really the critical parts to protecting yourself during the hottest weather, in addition to making sure you're doing things like being hydrated, seeking shady areas, and trying not to be outdoors in direct sunlight during the hottest parts of the day.
I remember from the big Chicago heat wave, was that back in the 90s? The advice really came out after that: check in on vulnerable people, seniors and others, especially if you know they don't have AC. Can you talk about the importance of being in touch with each other during an event like that?
Really, a communications plan is essential when it comes to any sorts of severe weather. You want to make sure that you have that list of contacts for individuals that you can seek help from in the event that you need it, but also to check in on them when a storm moves through the area or a heat event, making sure that you're checking in, especially on elderly neighbors or those who have, you know, disabilities or difficulty getting around on their own and may not have access to something that could be crucial in those kinds of conditions. Making sure you're checking in on them regularly, and if they need assistance, finding a way to get them that help.
Then, of course, tornadoes. I mean, I've lived my whole life in the Midwest, so I feel like most of us know what we need to know, but remind us what we do in cases of tornado watches, tornado warnings.
A watch is when the conditions are right for those tornadoes to develop, and really that's just a sign that you need to be aware of that potential. But when that warning is issued for your area, you know, that is an indication that there is a threat directly affecting you and that you need to take action. And really that first thing is, you know, get to a sturdy shelter, whether that be a basement or a ground floor interior room of a built home. You know, those are the areas that you should really be going to seek shelter. The main goal is to put as much distance between you and the outside as possible, because really it's that flying debris that's often kicked up by those strong winds that poses the greatest risk to people.
And then I saw earlier this week was an awareness day for lightning safety. People don't think about it. Again, we're in the Midwest. This is a risk.
Absolutely. You know, lightning can strike miles away from a storm itself. And it's really important to pay attention. If you see that lightning or hear thunder, you know, it's a sign that you could be at risk and that you need to seek shelter indoors, you know, away from trees. Really, there's not any safe place outside. Even a shelter at a park is not a safe place to be from lightning. You really want to get into an enclosed space in order to protect yourself.
And finally, flooding. We've already had some tragic deaths related to flooding in the state this year. A couple key pointers.
Really, the first and foremost thing is stay out of floodwaters. You know, don't drive through them. Don't walk through them. It really only takes a few inches of moving water to knock a person over and potentially carry them away. You know, less than a foot of water can carry most small vehicles away. So it's important to just stay out of the water when you encounter it during a flooding situation. You don't know what the surface of the road is going to look like beneath the surface of that water. And a road that you drove across 20 minutes ago may have crumbled beneath, and you could easily find yourself in a dangerous situation quickly.
Talking to Andrew Beckett with Wisconsin Emergency Management, looking at extreme weather events, how to be ready for them. Now, bigger picture, Andrew, when a tornado, say, hits a community or a major flood, can you talk about the reaction to that disaster, the first steps?
Well, really, the first steps is to make sure that everybody's okay and that they've gotten out safely and are not in immediate danger or have any serious injuries. Afterwards, you know, you want to make sure that you are documenting any damage that was done to your home, contacting local authorities if there is a risk on your property, you know, a tree that's hanging down and might potentially injure somebody if it falls, or utility lines that might be down. You don't want to approach them, but you want to make sure you contact your utility provider with that information so that they can get out there and address the problem as quickly as possible. And, you know, you want to make sure that you are identifying what you need to do in order to help get your life back on track, whether that's contacting your insurance provider, finding out what they need in order to help try and help repair that damage. You know, those are the steps that are really important in the immediate aftermath so that you can work on your recovery as quick as possible.
And you mentioned the insurance company, and I know in disasters around the country, sometimes people are surprised at the wrong moment about what insurance does and doesn't cover when it comes to disasters. What kind of things should people be thinking about, you know, before that disaster strikes?
It's important to make sure you know what your policy covers and then identify what needs to be done with that policy in order to make sure that you have coverage for those things that you may not have thought about. You know, most private homeowners insurance policies do not cover flooding. You either need to purchase flood insurance or maybe even get a rider on your existing policy in order to address any issues that you might see as a result of floodwaters. You know, those are the kind of things that's important to find out about in advance because it does take time for insurance coverage to take effect. So really talk to your insurance agent, identify what your policy does and does not cover, and identify how you can go about getting your policy expanded potentially if you feel it's needed.
Now, what does it mean when a governor of Wisconsin declares a state of emergency following some kind of natural disaster?
Well, a state of emergency is really a move that is intended to help mobilize state resources if they're requested, whether that be, you know, assistance with debris removal, potentially bringing in the National Guard for assistance. I mean, really, that is a step taken in order to help get the process moving for the deployment of resources quickly if they're requested.
What kind of resources, Andrew, do you point people toward to be ready for natural disasters in the state?
Well, our website, the Ready Wisconsin website, readywisconsin.wi.gov, has a wealth of information on there for the different kinds of threats that exist in the state, but also the things that people can do in order to make their own home emergency kit and make that plan for what to do when they're faced with different types of disasters.
What should be in our home emergency kit?
Home emergency kit should include a basic 72-hour supply of food and water because it may take time for assistance to get there. Things like battery-operated flashlights, a hand crank weather radio is a great idea. And then in first aid supplies and other essentials that you might need in the immediate aftermath of an incident.
And do you recommend people kind of review their kits? I know with flashlights in particular, they don't last forever.
Absolutely. Every year is really a good idea to kind of go through those kits and check those expiration dates. Batteries, even non-perishable food sometimes does have a bit of a shelf life, and you may want to consider replacing canned goods every few years. You know, those are the kind of things that should be checked regularly, especially when it comes to things like first aid kits. You don't want to have old medications or even antibiotic or first aid supplies that have gone past their expiration date for when you really need them.
Andrew, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Andrew Beckett is a public information officer with Wisconsin Emergency Management. He joined us today to talk about what happens after a natural disaster strikes and how you can prepare for storms and other extreme weather events this summer. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday with great Mexican recipes that sample the wide range of cooking styles from all over Mexico. We'll meet the author of Mi Cocina. You can get started right now with a few recipes online at WPR.org/Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.